Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Avanti Centre wrote her first book at age 4. She explored Europe, New Zealand, Canada, and Central America. She worked as a raft guide on the American River, spent years as a Silicon Valley IT executive, and has now turned her attention to writing thrillers in the Van Ops series. Van Ops is a new book series that combines historical mystery and science to create international intrigue. Drawing on her interest in psychology, mysticism, world history, science, religions, and mythology, author Avanti Centre has written the first in the Van Ops series, The Lost Power. Avanti Centre, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm thrilled to be here.
There's something you do that I wish all fiction writers would do. If there's any truth in their story, I like to know, well, did this really happen? Was this really true? Or is this total imagination coming out? And you give us, in the back of your book, your author's notes. And you tell us, yes, this is really true. Because some of it's hard to believe.
It is. Some of it is hard to believe. And I also love it when an author shares that. And I thought I would return the favor.
So thank you. You start out by saying that there was this first king of Spain. Actually, before there was even a Spain, he was a king in Aragon.
That's right.
And I happen to be fascinated with Spanish history because I've spent a good bit of time in Spain, and I'm always wondering about the history of these places that I go. And you tell us that Ramiro I was the first king of Spain, and Isabella the first and Ferdinand the second were his descendants.
That's right. I didn't know that until I started researching for the book, and I found it fascinating and found a couple of ways to work that into the story.
Because most of us, our knowledge of Spanish history starts with Isabella and Ferdinand. And you go back to this king named Ramiro. And you say that most of the current European monarchs are descended from Ferdinand and Isabella.
It's true.
And you say, for example, the current king of Spain, King Felipe VI. And that brought me up to current because I'm still remembering Juan Carlos when he was king. Now, he's the older generation, and there's this young guy, a descendant of this first king that you talk about. Also true that other monarchs currently reigning in Europe, for example, the King of Belgium, the Grand Duke of Luxembourg, Queen Elizabeth of the UK, the Queen of Denmark, the King of Norway, the King of Sweden, the King of the Netherlands, they all descended from Isabella and Ferdinand.
They did, and I found that so interesting, and I took it one step further. I thought, what if they all had a secret sect of spies? What if all their, you know, because we've got the CIA here in America, but I thought, what's the EU equivalent? I'm sure that each of the countries has their own spydom, but what if they all talked? What if they had some kind of connection?
You know, sometimes when authors think they're writing fiction, there's some truth there that nobody even knows about.
There could very well be.
And you say also the sovereign princes of Europe, for example, the Prince of Monaco and the Prince of Liechtenstein, also descendants as well as all these kings.
They're all related. I didn't know until I researched the story.
Well, so that is fascinating. It sent me looking up Ramiro and all these previous kings, because you go way back. You go back to Spain in 1057.
That's when Ramiro was around, and I needed somebody to establish the quest that the story is all about. And I wanted to pull in Alexander the Great's mysterious Egyptian weapon. And so the prologue is all about Ramiro wrestling that weapon away from the Moors. And he finds it to be so incredibly dangerous that he hides it so that only the best of his progeny can find it.
In fact, in reading your book, I thought, well, how did Ramiro die in reality? So I Googled that to find out how and where Ramiro actually died. And this connection with, as far as we know, Alexander the Great is fiction.
That's right.
But who knows?
But who knows?
On your cover, there's this interesting cross. Because I have a T-shirt, for example, with the cross of Languedoc. They don't call it Languedoc now. They call it Occitanie. I have this special cross. And, of course, most people are familiar with the Latin cross. But this cross on the cover, I don't think I ever saw that cross before. Can you possibly describe it?
Absolutely. It's a thorned cross, and it was the sign of Ramiro, the Signum Regis. And it's a regular kind of cross in that it's a little bit longer top to bottom, so it's not square. And each of the ends of the cross is flanged out a little bit, and at the bottom, there's a stake. I found the symbol while I was researching, thought it interesting, and turned it into the sign that the heroes chase as they're working their way around the globe trying to solve this quest that Ramiro left them. I thought, well, what better than to have him leave his mark in the places where they're trying to find the hidden clues that he left?
So his mark, his sign, was this thorned cross, as you describe it. So that's on your cover. And then there are lightning bolts extending out from this cross. And the lightning is powerful.
Lightning is very powerful, and I thought, what better than to have lightning be part of what they're trying to find, part of the weapon? And so we pull in something that's not commonly even really known much about, but ball lightning. Scientists believe that ball lightning is truly a phenomenon, and I read some fascinating accounts of pilots that had ball lightning come into a cockpit while they're flying, and this little ball of lightning popped around the cabin. There's quite some stories about ball lightning.
Yeah, because in your author's notes at the back, you say most researchers today agree that ball lightning is real, yet its nature remains controversial. And you say it often appears as a glowing sphere which moves or drifts horizontally through the air. I think if any of us, you know, normal laymen, saw such a thing, we would dismiss it and think, oh, it was our imagination. We didn't really see that. But now that you tell us this really does exist, maybe we'll keep an eye out. You say typically it's the size of a softball or a grapefruit, but sometimes appears as small as a dime or as large as a bus.
Can you believe that? Huge.
That is hard to believe. And you said it can hover or bounce and last for only a few seconds, but can linger for longer. Sometimes it disappears quietly, and other times explodes violently.
Yeah, and if you had a weapon that could throw that, if Alexander the Great had a weapon that could throw that kind of lightning, maybe he could conquer the world with something like that.
Who knows? Maybe he did.
Yeah, and if Russians were trying to find that today, oh, we would want to keep them from having that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing, since you mentioned the Russians, I did not know that the most effective military snipers in history was a woman. One of the most effective snipers was a woman. And you tell us that she had 309 kills. And so you incorporate a female sniper in your book. You say female snipers were part of World War II for the Soviet Union.
That's right. And the way that I incorporated a female sniper was I made her the grandmother of our bad guy, our sniper who's chasing our heroes around the globe. I thought, who better to train him than a World War II sniper?
Yeah, because the timing would be right that she would be his grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess I never thought of that, but you said there was this Soviet sniper, in quotes, Lady Death. Mm-hmm. Was a Russian Red Army Soviet sniper.
Yeah, they ran out of guys.
Gosh. You also mentioned that the CIA is willing to use whatever works.
That's right.
And if psychic spy works, then they're going to sign up for it. And you mentioned that several books have been written about the psychic spy program run by the CIA in the 1970s. And the military is training soldiers in mindfulness.
That's right. Yeah. I had read a number of years ago several of those books about the psychic spy program, and it captured my imagination. And what they did was they tried to – what they called it remote viewing. And what they did was they'd put a guy in a room, and they would try to get him to find a target. And according to some of the people that wrote the books that were in these programs, they had a fair amount of success. They also tried to do something even more controversial where they tried to be able to kill at a distance, remote killing. That didn't work out so well.
I might remind listeners that my guest is Avanti Centre, and she has a series, Vanops series, and the first in this series, The Lost Power. And we've been talking about some of this power that really exists that we aren't typically aware of, like this ball lightning. And so you incorporate all these features of reality into your story. And actually, nothing takes me out of a story than something that I know is not true, mm-hmm. that doesn't ring true for me. So these things that you, I'm so glad you told us these things that you have incorporated that actually are true.
I agree. And it was a fun trick to try to balance some of the more fantastical elements in the story and ground them in science. So there's, the ball lightning. We stretched things just a little bit in the how do we throw the ball lightning from the weapon that we find. And that's really the only place that I stretched reality. And who knows what human energy can do. Our heroine, I mentioned the meditation in there because she ends up learning to move her energy. She's an Aikido instructor, and she ends up learning to move her energy into these weapons to throw ball lightning. And I don't even find that to be that much of a stretch, but that's really about the biggest fiction in the story.
In fact, one of your notes in your author's notes made me wonder if you studied Kundalini yoga, because you say if you'd like to learn more about the power that this protagonist, this woman named Maddie, experiences, I suggest finding a local Kundalini yoga class.
That's right. I love Kundalini yoga. I've been practicing since my mid-20s and frankly have been able to move some of my own internal energy. So that's why it's also not that much of a stretch for me that our heroine could move some energy into this weapon and cause some damage.
My guest is Avanti Centre, and we're talking about her book, The Lost Power, which is the first in a series of mystery thrillers. Now, you're mentioning science, and you even the very first page of your book, you quote Nikola Tesla, and he says, "I'm part of a light, and it is the music. The light fills my six senses." Six senses, now he says. This is Tesla talking. "I see it, hear, feel, smell, touch, and think. Thinking of it means my sixth sense. Particles of light are written note. A bolt of lightning can be an entire sonata. 1,000 balls of lightning is a concert."
So even Nikola was aware of ball lightning.
Yeah.
Not surprising.
Yeah. So he is saying that he equates music and as light energy.
That's right.
We've been talking about things that we didn't know. I didn't know as your reader. My gosh, I didn't know that. And there's even, you quote, sources that we have maybe have encountered. For example, you quote CBS News, March 25th of 2003. And what did CBS News say?
CBS News on that date said, "The U.S. Air Force has hit a rocky TV with an experimental electromagnetic pulse device called the E-bomb in an attempt to knock it off the air and shut down Saddam Hussein's propaganda machine. Iraqi satellite TV, which broadcasts 24 hours a day outside Iraq, went off the air around 4:30 a.m. local time."
And even though I do watch, not that regular, but CBS News, and I watch it, that just went right past me. I did not, that didn't register as something that would have been a wow reaction.
E-bomb weapons are real.
Now, were you probably weren't aware of that at that time, were you, in 2003?
No, I wasn't. And the more I dug into it, the more fascinated I became. These weapons can melt our electronics, our phones, clocks on the wall, like Salvador Dali paintings. They can, you know, turn these electronics into just melted metal. So these are very powerful weapons. And a lot of the information about them is highly classified. But I was able to find a book that talked a lot about the E-bomb weapon and what it can do.
You know, speaking of melting phones, one of the scariest parts of your book is when the protagonist and her brother have to crush their phones. Oh, my gosh.
Pained them, and it pained me, too. And they joke about it. You know, they're missing a limb. It's like a phantom limb not having their phones. They go through the whole book off-grid.
Yeah. And you might mention why they had to crush their phones.
Shortly after the inciting incident of the novel, which is a double murder in Napa, they're going to the attorney's office to try to find more information because one of the people that was killed there in Napa tells them to go there. Well, on their way, they are chased by these same people that they believe committed the double homicide originally, and they don't know how they were tracked, how they were followed. So it becomes a huge shootout in Midtown Sacramento, and they decide, oh my gosh, it's possible that either we were overheard or we were somehow tracked. So we have no choice but to destroy our phones.
So that we can't be tracked.
Right.
Now, on this same page entitled Ripped from Recent Headlines, we have this from 2003. And then from Science News in 2018, you have a quote there. Would you read that?
I will. The quote is, "Some meteorites contain superconducting bits. Find energizes search for exotic materials that conduct electricity sand resistance." And this cracked me up because you'll note the date on here, 2018.
Yeah.
I started writing this book in late 2014.
Oh.
Scientists didn't discover that there were potentially superconducting meteorites until after I had finished the book. And so this was one of the late additions.
So you started writing your book in 2013, and then this comes out in Science News March 7th of 2018.
Right. To tie all that together, we were talking about the E-bomb weapon a little bit ago and how we really don't know a whole lot about those. But one of the things that is strongly suspected is that they're fueled from superconductors. And superconductors are a lot like people think about copper as a conductor. It conducts electricity. A superconductor will do the same thing. It will conduct electricity only without the resistance of copper. So it's almost like an infinite type of energy source. And they think that they're using that superconductive type of material to power things like the E-bomb. And so as we go through the story, we learn that the weapon is made of a superconducting material that was fictional, but a lot of this information about superconductors is factual.
In fact, as I was reading this, I asked a friend within earshot, and I said, "Laurandite, have you ever heard of that?" And he said, "No." But you tell us about that. You say, this is your page of what is true. Laurandite is a ruby-red colored mineral that was mined in southern Macedonia from the Altar deposit. Though rare, it is the most common thallium-bearing mineral. And what a wonderful characteristic that is conductive but without resistance.
That is a hugely powerful characteristic, and scientists today are making all kinds of things from superconducting materials. If you've ever had an MRI, if you know about the really fast bullet trains in Japan, those all take advantage of that superconducting ability.
Avanti Centre's historical mystery novel is The Lost Power. I'll continue my conversation with Avanti after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Weekman. I'm Nancy Weekman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Mystery writer Avanti Centre has written the first in her Vanops book series. And in this book, she blends intrigue, history, science, and mystery into this thriller. And it's the first of a series that she calls Vanops. and Vanguard Operations.
That's right. Yeah.
So this is your debut novel, and you introduce us to some characters. And before you introduce the 21st century character, you tell us about this character in Aragon in 1057. Now, we did refer to him, but would you read a little bit of that, your prologue?
Sure. Ramiro needed a way to halt the spheres of ball lightning that killed and tormented his troops. They fell like a meteor shower, unstoppable arrows of piercing light.
So you assume that if this ball lightning exists today in the 21st century, it surely must have existed back in 1057.
Absolutely. And back in 1057, can you imagine what type of a weapon that would have been, or in Alexander's day? Talk about using advanced technology. It would have been incredibly deadly.
And we assume that we know everything about the weapons they used in those days, but maybe we don't.
Perhaps not.
Well, let's get to the characters that you create to have this adventure. And one of them we mentioned, his name is Maddie. So would you read a little bit about this internal conflict that Maddie has?
Absolutely. So this is from the first chapter from Maddie's perspective. As she headed toward her father's vineyard, Maddie drove as fast as she dared down a familiar tree-lined Napa County lane. Today, she didn't recognize the road. It looked eerie and unnatural. The area was draped in sheets of fog from yesterday's unseasonable rain, and the silver half-light gave the trees an ethereal patina. "Sensei, would you kill someone if you had to?" AJ asked. Surprised, Maddie frowned. "I'm not a sensei yet, remember?" She paused for a moment before she replied to his query. "Where did that question come from?" "We were talking about it in the locker room at the dojo after class. We know Aikido is about nonviolence, but what if you don't have a choice?" His voice dropped to a dramatic whisper. "What if it was kill or be killed?" Maddie shook her head. "The things children thought about. I would always look for another way."
This is Avante Centre reading from her book, The Lost Power. And in this, we learn that the story starts in Napa Valley.
That's right.
With this 30-year-old Maddie, who is the protagonist. And then she has a twin brother. So would you read the part where we see the sister, Maddie's, perspective of Will, her twin brother? This is on page 10 in your book.
Sure. Will closed the trunk of the Mustang, moved around to the other side of the car, and watched AJ and the dog playing. Dressed in his usual style, he wore tan cargo shorts, leather sandals, and a dark blue Ralph Lauren polo shirt. Ever prepared for disaster, he had a small flashlight hanging from the front of his shorts, and she figured he had a knife in his pocket. He was holding two small travel bags and managed to cradle a book in his hand, without a doubt a geeky physics book.
Now then, Maddie is talking about this clench she has in her stomach, and she's trying to ignore it, and she says, "We've both been working too hard." But what then? Would you pick up there and read part of your story?
Yeah, they're fighting a little bit, Maddie and her brother Will.
A brother and a sister disagree?
Weird, I know.
Who would have imagined?
Yeah, they haven't seen each other for a while, and they haven't gotten along very well since high school. So in this situation on Chapter 4, she lashed out, her voice rising more than she intended. "Was that wise, bringing her? Do you even know what Dad wants?" As a side note, they're talking about Will's wife. Will took a deep breath. "Jesus, simmer down. I thought I was the worrier of the family." He met her gaze. "Maria was up for a change of scenery, so we planned a romantic wine country vacation. You know, the train, mud baths, that sort of thing. We might even stop by Safari West. Besides, you brought company." He nodded towards AJ. "Who's the little guy?" "His name is AJ. He's a foster kid from the dojo, and it's his birthday." She watched AJ and the dog play a spontaneous game of tag. "Is that all Dad wants with us? A vacation?" He sounded concerned on the message he left me.
Now, we did meet AJ in a little bit earlier passage that you read, this young guy who's a foster kid.
Yeah,
from
wondering
the dojo.
If you would kill if you had to.
Yeah. But now she practices Aikido, doesn't she?
She does. That's why she thinks, "No, I'd never kill anybody. There's always another way. I'm all about nonviolence."
Yeah.
So it sets up some interesting conflict throughout the story as she's chased by a Russian sniper.
And this Russian sniper, you call him?
Ivan.
So that's a very Russian name. And then what does Ivan think of Maddie and Will?
So this snippet in chapter 5 is a conversation between Ivan and his partner. And Ivan says, "She's female, young, maybe 30, slim with an olive complexion, has long, sexy, dark hair and a ponytail, and is tall, pretty tall for a woman. Rape bait, if you ask me, dressed in jeans and a snug purple T-shirt," his partner said. There was a long pause. The sniper adjusted his hold on the rifle, concentrating. He'd read the dossiers on Maddie Marshall and her twin brother, Will Argonis. Argonis was an engineer and no real threat. But the Marshall woman, a world-class athlete and national ski champion who had been a favorite for Olympic gold, she'd used her lightning-fast reflexes to become a warrior in an unusual martial art. And she was gifted with a keen intelligence, a dangerous combination. In another time and place, he'd have been interested in her as a mate. He swore. Based on his orders, their arrival meant he had run out of time.
This is Avanti Centre reading from her book, The Lost Power, which is the first in her Van Ops series of thrillers. So we meet this sniper, and he's giving his opinion of Maddie. And there's, on page 43, Avanti, you have a sentence, I think, wow, what a great opening sentence. Here's what you wrote. You said, this is Will, the brother, the twin brother. "He was certain this was undoubtedly the harbinger of a dangerous scenario. An engineer by training and a skeptic by nature, getting shot at in the morning and being handed diamonds in the afternoon was just not his cup of tea."
That's right.
Once shot at the morning, in the morning, mm-hmm. and diamonds in the afternoon. My gosh.
It's a crazy day for Will and Maddie. Yeah, they make their way to Sacramento, and as we mentioned earlier, they get shot at there, and they have to flee somewhere. So they get on the freeway, and they're trying to figure out, do they go back to Maddie's loft in San Francisco? Do they head back to Napa? They end up heading to Tahoe. Has anybody in the listening audience ever been to Lake Tahoe?
And why Lake Tahoe?
Well, they grew up in Lake Tahoe, and they thought, well, Dad sold the family house, but we're familiar with it. It's vacant. Some snow bunnies live there. The story takes place in the summer, so we feel like it would be a good place to go to where no one will find us.
And they know how to get in.
Yes. There was a broken latch on the window that might possibly still be broken.
Well, speaking of Lake Tahoe, they go to this, what you call the Fire Sign Cafe. And what happens there in the Fire Sign Cafe?
At the Fire Sign Cafe, while Will and Maddie are having breakfast, all of a sudden a shadow appears over the table, and they look up, and it's Bear Thorenson.
Bear, of course, is a nickname.
Bear is a nickname, yes. His name's Theodore, and it became Bear over the years. And so he asks if he can join them for breakfast.
And so would you read a little bit of that?
Absolutely. Will felt uneasy at the overt masculine energy emanating from Bear. It was like a strong smell. He hadn't remembered Bear's shoulders being quite so hefty. Although he was a running back on the high school football team, Bear had a definite presence to him now, but Will wasn't sure he could trust him. In his experience, men with that many muscles didn't have much in the way of brains. And why was he here? There'd been a lot of coincidences lately, and this one on top of yesterday's grief made Will feel uneasy.
There's also something else that you follow up that gives us a clue of where he might have grown up, because when Bear orders breakfast, he orders scrambled eggs, toast, like you might expect, bacon, and iced sweet tea.
Bear has a southern drawl.
Why, yes, that's what I guessed when he drinks sweet tea.
That's right. He grew up in North Carolina.
North Carolina, they drink sweet tea.
They sure do.
So that was a realistic touch for me, Avanti, when I'm reading your book. And Maddie then shares her desire to start her own dojo someday. And she talked about her job developing mobile apps for smartphones. And she shared that she'd taken on her mother's maiden name.
She had, yes. Yeah. So Will is an Argonis. He descends from the first king of Aragon, and as such has that family name, and Maddie did too growing up. Their mother died when they were young, and so Maddie along the way decided to give some homage to her mother and took on Marshall as her last name.
My guest is Avanti Centre, and she has written a book, a thriller, The Lost Power, and she includes a lot of information that is really true that we would never suspect as being true. So now eventually you get around to this, the name of this series, your series of thrillers is Van Ops. And then this is on later in your book, you introduce, and this is Bear now, introduces Van Ops.
He does. So this is in chapter 40, and after some unfortunate things have happened to our heroes. So Bear says, or is thinking, in the light of failure, he'd considered going home. Then he wondered how an aborted mission would affect his prospects with Van Ops, a clandestine group operating under the CIA's Department of Extreme Threats. The director of the group had arranged for him to come on this mission. He wished he could tell Maddie about Van Ops, but he was sworn to secrecy that evening at Jake's, his favorite lakeside restaurant.
And this is a passage from The Lost Power. And the author, Avanti Centre, is reading from this series. Now, it is a series, so I assume that you're probably working on the next in the series.
I am finished with the next in the series.
Oh.
It's currently called The Solstice Countdown. That's the third or fourth title. And my agent is shopping it at the moment.
Well, I don't want to go further in this, your first series, because I don't want to be a spoiler and spoil the surprises. I will mention that they travel a lot of other places besides Lake Tahoe. It's the first place they go because they want to follow up on this mystery that they're uncovering.
That's right. And then they go to Spain, and from there they get a clue. And they have to follow the clue to figure out who murdered the people that they care about at the beginning of the story.
So thank you for telling us some of these things that are true that are as thrilling and mysterious as the invention of this story that you incorporate all these things into.
Well, I've really enjoyed being here, and I hope that readers enjoy the story as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Well, we'll look forward to. Tell us again the name of the one you've just finished.
The second book in the series is The Solstice Countdown. The first one, which is available at retailers everywhere, is Van Ops, The Lost Power.
Thank you, Avanti.
Thank you, Nancy.
Avanti Centre's thriller is The Lost Power. After a break, suspense writer Howard Levine will tell us about his latest novel, Last Gasp. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Howard Levine is a former special education in English as a second language teacher. Before his first public teachings position at a high school in the Bronx, he taught transcendental meditation, which he still practices regularly. He now lives in the suburb of Washington, D.C., and volunteers with his wife at a soup kitchen and senior citizen center. He's author of two novels, Leaving This Life Behind, and his latest, a thriller mystery called Last Gasp. Howard Levine, welcome.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
Well, now, I wondered why you had your book set in the Bronx, because chapter one, you tell us this is 2010, the Bronx. And so I thought, well, but he lives in Washington, D.C. How does he know about the Bronx?
I lived there the first 36 years of my life, so the scene and the characters are familiar to me. So it was just a comfortable setting for the novel.
I did wonder how the characters were familiar to you because you taught special education, English as a second language, and you weren't a policeman yourself. So how did you know about the police work?
Well, I did some research, and, you know, when I say that the characters are familiar to me, the type of people that they are.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we sort of grew up in the same neighborhood, figuratively speaking. And also, in terms of the setting, the area in which the terrorist attack in the novel takes place, Co-op City, is a very ideal area for that because it's extremely dense in terms of population and such. So that was another factor.
Well, since you mentioned that, let's take a look at chapter one. I mentioned that you tell us it's taking place in the Bronx in 2010, and you have a character named Billy Patterson. Now, who is Billy Patterson? Who do you tell us he is in the very opening paragraphs of chapter one?
Well, Billy Patterson, what we can tell from the segment I'm going to read is that he's kind of a religious fanatic, someone who never really had stability in his life. And as we'll see in the segment, he takes it in his head to perform this terrible terrorist act. He doesn't take it in his head. He's kind of doing it at the behest of a right-wing U.S. government. But he's kind of the point man. And we see in the segment that, you know, he's a religious fanatic who has his own motivation for doing what he does.
Okay, well, why don't you read this section where the corners of Patterson's tight lips twitched?
Okay, we'll do that then. Okay, so the corners of Patterson's tight lips twitched with unbidden mirth at the thought that the concert would indeed be a gas, but not for the sleeping god who would die via a bullet from the plastic gun Patterson had carried in with him. A few simple pieces of equipment, a forged ticket and the gun, and all of the security measures in place within the arena, starting with the metal detectors, were worthless. Security, anti-terrorism, kill the jihadist before he kills you, but let the more insidious terrorists, the ones who poison souls, waltz right into the arena and set up on stage. Provide them with a devil-worshipping audience, sold out.
This is Howard Levine, reading from his latest novel. He has two novels. This is Last Gasp, and he's just been introducing a character named Billy Patterson, and there's an arena where there's a concert. So now, if we go a little bit further into the story, there's a security camera, and this is on page four, Howard, the middle of the page,
yeah.
Locating the security camera, they were never that hard to find. Would you read that paragraph for us?
Just let me find it for a second. Okay. Locating the security camera, they were never that hard to find. It was like he could feel their subtle heat on his skin. He faced it and defiantly bellowed what he considered some blasphemy of his own. If they couldn't pick it up over that amplified trash, well, then they could read his lips. Patterson stuck the gun under his belt and laid the canister and gas mask at his feet, a safe distance from the spreading pool of the god's blood. Then he removed the gloves. Ordinarily, picking the lock on the door of the room housing the intake unit would have been a piece of cake, only slightly more difficult than shifting gears on a manual transmission, if there were any of those left around. But he was a bit shaky, more with excitement than fear. He rarely used two hands as he did now, one to steady the other. Still, the job was done in no more than a minute. He stepped into the room, into the destiny that had been awaiting him his entire life. Of that, he had no doubts.
This is author Howard Levine, and he's reading from his second novel, a thriller, and it's called Last Gasp. Last Gasp is a novel that really resonates in today's politics. And Howard is recounting this story, but so far we have not met the main characters. And who are the main characters, Howard?
Okay, well, the main character is Frank Tedeschi. Now, Billy Patterson worked for him part-time in his hardware store and kind of let slip his plans for this concert that he was going to guess. Frank didn't really take him seriously, okay? And then Frank's niece, Laureen, dies in the attack, okay? And Frank and his grieving, formerly estranged brother, Rob, a detective with the NYPD, eventually wind up seeking to prove the truth about what happened because a right-wing U.S. government blames the attack on Islamic jihadists.
Okay, well, would you pick up at chapter 4? And the very first word in that chapter is Bobby. The second word is Rob. And this is Frank's brother. You've just been telling us about Frank.
I'm ready for you this time, Nancy. So,
would you read that?
Sure. Okay. Bobby, Rob, Frank's biological brother, picked the name. A lot of what they'd called each other over the years would have been unprintable back in the day, back when they had a relatively good relationship. His brother Frank, not having been inclined toward bullying, getting his combat fix as a high school wrestler who took it to the mats, or so they joked, residents of Pelham Bay, Little Italy in the Bronx. Back before Frank, bored with life in the neighborhood, capable but not especially interested in going to college, had enlisted in the army. He chipped out to Vietnam. Amazed to eventually find himself home again in one piece, if a mite skittish mentally, he dedicated himself to protesting the war, wearing his camouflage fatigues and long hair. While Frank was still overseas, Rob had been admitted to the police academy. He became a rookie cop, Piglet in the vernacular of the counterculture, whose brother was demonstrating in the streets and clashing with New York's finest. The rift that developed between them only widened over time. As he drove down now to meet Rob, jazz up loud, a hedge against drowsiness, Frank tried to distill all of that time, traverse in reverse, summon the brotherly affection that he dimly remembered feeling back in the day. How was he going to console Rob? That was what it would amount to. Laureen was gone. He knew that in his guts, news reports aside. Maybe consoling Rob somehow might help him to console himself. As he moved left to pass a tank-like SUV, no easy feat, the guy was well above the speed limit, its taillights shimmered and blurred. Fortunately, traffic was sparse on the Strain Brook in the wee hours. Rob was prowling in front of his parked car on 233rd Street, above the Bronx River Parkway, jacketless with short sleeves in the autumn chill. He waved one thick arm above his head. Frank couldn't possibly miss him, even without the roof of his car flashing red. The way Rob squinted in the direction of Frank's windshield, furrowing his forehead with its receding hairline, that square-shouldered torso, his stomp walk, all of this was caught in the ultraviolet gleam of the street lamp. Frank pulled to the curb behind Rob and jumped out.
This is Howard Levine reading from his thriller suspense novel, Last Gasp. And in this chapter, we meet these two brothers, and one of the brother has lost a daughter. You mentioned that the one brother was wondering, well, how is he going to console his brother Rob after his daughter, Laureen, had died? And one thing that I liked about your book, Howard, is that, now, these brothers are estranged, but for the most part, I mean, you have to have drama in your novel, but it's not between the husband and wife. And I like the fact that you show us that Frank and Julie, Frank's wife is named Julie, and they have such a nice relationship. And so I appreciated that in your book. Later on, when Julie doesn't know what Frank has been undergoing, and she wants to know. And he's reluctant to tell her. That's understandable. And he just says, Julie, it was a mess. Seriously, you really want to hear about it? He said finally. And she replies, no, I don't. But Frank, I need to. Whatever happened, I need you to tell me about it, even if I freak out at first. She squeezed his hand. I can't not know. It's like I'm you and you are me. If that sounds like the Beatles, whatever, I'm sorry. But you understand what I'm saying. And so I thought that was such a tender scene that this wife wants to know what her husband's been through. He's reluctant to tell her because it would be hard for them both to hear. But their love for each other comes across. So in spite of all that transpires, and I won't spoil the suspense for people who read your novel.
Right, yeah.
But in spite of all he goes through, when he sees his wife again, there's this tender moment between the two of them.
Well, and you read it very well, I must say.
Thank you. Well, you mentioned in your introduction you thank your wife, your own wife, is a support in your endeavors as a writer. So I'm sure you'd like to give her a shout out too.
Very much so, yes. Yes, she's my editor-in-chief.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Howard, about your latest novel, Last Gasp. And people can check this out and find out all the mysteries.
Right. Well, the heart of the novel is Frank and Rob's mission to prove the truth about what happened in the face of government duplicity. And as you mentioned earlier, that's very topical given today's politics. So,
yeah. And here's this Vietnam vet, and the brother named Rob is a detective with the New York Police Department. And mm-hmm. the two brothers work together. And that's nice, too, because they had been estranged, and here was an opportunity for them to work together. So thank you, Howard.
Thank you very much.
Former Chico News and Review columnist Anthony Peyton Porter has a poem for us today.
This is from Ronald Wallace, entitled Blessings. Blessings occur. Some days I find myself putting my foot in the same stream twice, leading a horse to water and making him drink. I have a clue. I can see the forest for the trees. All around me, people are making silk purses out of sow's ears, getting blood from turnips, building Rome in a day. There's a business like show business. There's something new under the sun. Some days, misery no longer loves company. It puts itself out of its. There's rest for the weary. There's turning back. There are guarantees. I can be serious. I can mean that. You can quite put your finger on it. Some days I know I am long for this world. I can go home again. And when I go, I can take it with me. I'm Anthony. Here's what I think. Imagine that you work somewhere, and there you see children, the same children every day. And you notice a toddler gradually seem to be getting sick. And eventually, over a week or so, he dies. You have done nothing to help. You watch this little boy with the bright eyes just shrink. He loses weight and then he just lies there. And he dies. You don't tell anybody. You don't ask anything. You just pass by him lying on the floor or on a board or something. And while you do your job, minding your own business, following orders. What are you like? What kind of person are you that you would do that? What's your personality type? Whatever it is, I think you should have your head examined. Imagine dragging an infant from her mother's arms so your coworkers can lock them up separately, miles apart. Do you know anybody who would forcibly separate a baby from its mother? Such people should have their heads examined. I saw a video recently of an armed peace officer, never mind the contradiction, with his knee in the back of a struggling child. A servant of the people with a gun put his knee in the back of an 11-year-old girl on our behalf. What a hero. If her father had kneed her, he would have been locked up. I don't think cops should do more than a father. In terms of serving and protecting, everything was hunky-dory until the cops got there. So these courageous peace officers weren't protecting her from anything. Maybe the knee guy is a chiropractor. Maybe he needs his head examined. Peace officers assaulted a child again. I still think peace officers should be educated in the humanities above all. And now I think therapy ought to be required, starting now. People who mistreat others, and we know them when we see them, must be suffering. Why else would they be like that? They're clearly unhappy, and a good therapist can help with that. So to sum up, it seems to me that the primary difference between SEAL Team 6 and the Manson family is that the Manson family, to its credit, included women. I'm Anthony Payton Porter.
I'd also like to thank my first guest, Avanti Centre, author of The Lost Power.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.